BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Ready?
Morning, Sheila.
Hello.
Oh, welcome.
We take our shoes off.
Sheila, hi Sheila.
Hello.
Hi,
hello, Deb. Hello, Deb. Very nice to meet you.
My name is Dev Sharma and I'm from Leicester.
I'm Sushant. I'm Dev's dad, Dara.
Dara.
Mum.
Dev's mum.
Shiv, Dev's younger brother.
Yeah. Finishing his breakfast. It is early in the morning, we don't often record this early.
No, it's absolutely fine, our pleasure.
A normal morning would look like waking up at 7, brushing my teeth, and then coming down, having breakfast, getting my books ready for school, and then leaving the house.
Last week, 7:30 in the morning. I don't make a habit of crashing people's breakfast, but Dev had agreed to let me come with him on his way to school.
They said it's the coldest day of the year today. It was on the radio.
Because Dev Sharma, who's 14, is one of many teenagers who's realised there's something a bit wrong with the food choices they're offered on the way to school, in town, wherever they go. In an average school class of 30, 10 and 11-year-olds, 6 are obese and 4 more are overweight. Twice as many as 30 years ago. And as we know, obesity brings in its wake a host of crippling, well, killing diseases. So in this, the first of two special programmes, I want to ask, how do we solve this?
The Food Programme! The place for hungry minds.
It's 24 minutes to 8. A ban on eating on buses and trains, extending the sugar tax, much tighter rules on advertising. As we've been hearing, these are just some of the suggestions being made by the Chief Medical Officer for England, who's standing down after 9 years.
Dame Sally Davis's suggestions came in the form of an independent report, 96 pages long, released in October 2019, aimed at politicians and policymakers now and in the future.
I think this is a failure of our society. We have had creeping up on us an environment that, because it's crept up on us, nobody really mentioned. And we need to call time on the fact that we are surrounded by a flood of unhealthy food and drink and advertising.
We're walking along a quite busy road. Tell us where we are and what we're doing.
So our school is situated off a ring road and we're about 100 metres down from the gate of our school. So you're going to see all the students walking down. If we look to our west, there's a big Sainsbury's supermarket right over there. There's a Feast India, which is like an Indian restaurant, it's like a buffet. Right opposite our school, there's a sweet shop next to it. There's a Subway next to it. There's a Greggs and there's a Morrison's. After school, you're going to see all the young people first going to the corner shop right opposite the school and then walk towards the Morrison's, and inside the Morrison, there's a Greggs and a Subway.
So do you also go to Subway and Morrison's and on your way home from school?
It's more like a social gathering over there after school. They sit around and then you also buy the food.
What about the weekends? I mean, do you go into town?
Yeah. When you go into town, you'll see the gatherings take place at fast food places, at the McDonald's, at the Clock Tower. You look north, south, east, west of Clock Tower, and you see a fast food restaurant. You see a Burger King behind you, you see a McDonald's on the right of you, you see a Five Guys in front of you, and on the left of you, there's a street full of more fast food restaurants, such as KFC.
Are there other places to gather?
It feels like the only place to meet to us and to young people. There's around 4 youth clubs left in city, a city with a size of 300,000 people. It's no surprise that you see young people gathering in big groups outside McDonald's because it's the only place for them to go now. So we're just coming near to the school gate.
You know, if you could change, if you were food czar, what would you change?
If I was such as czar of Leicester. So you look at our street and you see the clear that there's a bus stop opposite. There's a bus stop opposite us, and there's an advert right in front of us.
Hi.
That keeps on changing. Sometimes it's food. On the other side, you see little corner shops, and I support local businesses, but I feel like making money off young people's health and children's health cannot be the way forward.
Come on, we're going to be locked out.
Would you like just to report to reception, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Walking to school with Dev, children are on their way to and from school are surrounded by temptations.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. There's good evidence from the United States that takeaway food outlets cluster disproportionately around schools, which suggests that takeaway owners are potentially aware of the market that is children and teenagers and are possibly actively basing their location choices on trying to capitalise on that market. Dr. Thomas Burgoyne, I am a public health geographer from the Centre for Diet and Activity Research and the MRC Epidemiology Unit at the University of Cambridge. And clearly food options are many and varied and capture lots of different types of food outlet. So we have some evidence that access to supermarkets is really important for having a healthy and varied diet. And then also with regards to takeaway food outlets, one of our studies of 5,000 people in the east of England, we found that compared to those people who had least exposure to takeaway food outlets around their homes and workplaces and the journeys between those two locations, they were almost twice as likely to be obese and consumed more takeaway food per week than those who were least exposed to takeaway food outlets. We know that takeaways clearly aren't the sole cause of obesity, but they're likely to be an important contributor. With respect to takeaways near schools, well, when researchers have spoken to children, they're often told how these outlets have strong appeal because the food that's sold is cheaper and perceived to be tastier than the food that's available in the school canteen, making takeaways kind of a good and often cool alternative, a place to hang out with their friends after school. And at the same time, it's certainly true that takeaways are actively trying to win the teenage pound by marketing and discounting foods directly to them in cut price student meal deals. I suppose the last thing I'd say is that we also know that the problem of access around schools is getting worse, and that numbers of fast food outlets are proliferating across the country over time and around schools in particular. And that growth is fastest in more deprived areas and around schools in more deprived areas. So of the fifth of local councils who are putting in place planning policies to tackle takeaways, the vast majority of those are focusing on schools and using exclusion zones around schools. So here we're talking about 400 to 800 meter radius buffers centered on schools. If a new takeaway owner or prospective owner applies for planning permission to open, the application will be denied. Really, implementation of these policies has only been kind of beginning in the last few years, so there hasn't been much research on kind of how effective they are. And to definitively prove the impact of a planning policy on health, you'd need to have, you know, a large study of people and follow them over time and see how their health changes in response to the intervention. But that would be incredibly expensive and probably infeasible, so we may never have that evidence.
You're listening to the Food Programme on BBC Radio 4. We want to hear from you about this. Do you have a question? And where would you start in trying to tackle childhood obesity? Next week, we'll have an expert panel in the studio, so get in touch. On social media, we are at BBC Food Prague, or email us, thefoodprogramme@bbc.co.uk.
Over 40% of young people live in poverty in Leicester. One in three young people go through food poverty. They're not having their basic three meals a day, or they're not having nutritious meals. My eyes opened up, and that's when I realised, wow, I've gone through this at school. This happens to my friends. At school, where nearly 30% of my friends have free school meals. This, like, really resonates with me.
If you think Dev sounds pretty eloquent on the food options available to him, that's because he's been campaigning for a fairer food system since he was 12. Now he's on the youth board of Bite Back 2030, a campaign backed by Jamie Oliver to empower young people with knowledge about how the food industry works.
What we're saying is, when you come out the house, you look on your phone, there's no way to find a healthy alternative when you're being flooded with millions of pounds worth of marketing. I'm going down my phone, social media, adverts, and on the TV. Turning over my bus ticket, wow, there's an offer for McDonald's. This endless circle, this endless trap of, even if you try to be healthy, you can't be healthy. And when you try to be healthy and buy healthy food, the labeling is misleading and it has two portions. It's just so confusing, especially for a young person who just wants to live their normal life and walk to school. That's what Bite Back's mission is. We're not saying you're good, you're bad. We're saying everyone's equal. It should be a fair place.
And Dev's campaigning has prompted discussions at home.
When we go to Pizza Hut now, first we will eat more salad than pizza.
We have actually started talking a lot more about the calorie count.
Calorie.
Yeah, the portion sizes.
Like, I've started cooking in olive oil now.
We're not saying that no unhealthy food at all, or just have healthy food all the time, because that's not justifiable. We still, as people, want to have our takeaways and want to have a takeout or have unhealthy food and have sweets or, you know, etc. But what we're saying is now we need to have it in moderation, and to live a balanced lifestyle, to live till the age of 80, if you say, you need to live a balanced life, including everything. So I think that's what the thing has been, like a presence around the house.
What Dev's learned through his campaigning has certainly had a serious impact at home. And we've heard it's on the agenda when it comes to town planning. But I wanted to ask Dev what was going on at his school, because schools have been a focus for government-backed healthy eating campaigns for a long time. And in Dame Sally Davis's report, there's a whole section on recommendations which say schools and nurseries should have a central role.
This is my amazing science teacher. He's Mr. Kurt. He's taught me for 2 years.
We're at Leicester City School. There's about 1,800 students here.
It's Chris Kurth, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I'll be a bit, you know, more casual. I'll call you Chris, if that's all right.
That's fine.
We're sitting in one of the canteens.
We've got our main restaurant, which is being used this morning. I mean, the food's fantastic in there. Particular favourite is the Lebanese on the Thursday, Dev. I'm sure you'd agree.
The only thing, and I've always said this, and this is with schools we've seen throughout the country, is we've seen that there's, like, options available, which are, like, the cheaper options of pizza, paninis. But at the same time, you have that standard meal, which is the healthy meal.
The temptations of these other things.
The temptations of these other things. And what I feel is, it's not the school's fault now.
Why is it not the school's fault?
Because, look at this, food is such a thing where you have to make profits. Looking for catering companies which are going to offer the best deal, but at the same time, at whose expense? The children's health?
Chris, so what do you think about what Dev just said?
The school has done a lot. I've been here for 18 years. I've seen the canteen go from turkey Twizzlers through to, you know, like Dev said, a balanced meal.
The school has played a huge part in children's health in saying that they've banned fizzy drinks in school.
And you've just passed me this slip of paper with a healthy eating champion. Tell me what this is.
Part of a programme that we've got established here where they do different activities and gain leadership badges. I mean, Dev's got some leadership badges, haven't you, Dev?
Chris, you know, what would you say to the government and the local council? I mean, what would you say that would really make a profound difference?
I think we're doing everything we can in schools. I think it's, you know, with regards to culture across the UK, it's pushing healthy choices, isn't it? If a child is leaving school at, you know, 3-4 o'clock and they've got money to go into a takeaway, the school can only go so far to sort of like educate and guide them.
You're very articulate, Dev. Do you feel that you're being listened to, both as a member of Bite Back but also in your other roles?
We're the victims, you could say, in all this, who have no power whatsoever. We can't vote. So we're at the forefront of this, and we're the victims with no voice at all. So there is a positive in it, because we have the most credibility to go out and make a change and speak for our generation, speak for that missing voice that needs to be heard.
Dev is extraordinary. And this school. I mean, it's an extraordinary place where children are self-confident and articulate and really want the world to be a better place. That was true of the 4- and 5-year-olds and 6- and 7-year-olds we met yesterday. Yesterday we went to a school that's engaging children at a much earlier age. We're going into apple tree class.
Hello.
Hello. My name is Jason O'Rourke and I'm head teacher at Washingborough Academy.
So we've all washed our hands.
Each of you have got a mushroom.
Yeah, well, we're going to see how it sounds when you cut into it.
I heard it soft.
How does soft sound, Harry?
It's when it's really quiet.
Tell me a bit about the school.
It's quite a large school for Lincolnshire. We've got about 300 children here. In the 10 years that I've been here, we've planted a Lincolnshire heritage orchard, all full of Lincolnshire varieties of apples like Peasgood Nonsuch and Grimaldi Greens. We've got hives full of bees. We've got a polytunnel. We've got kitchen gardens.
Why were you interested in doing this?
The magic thing about education is to get them learning and they don't know they're learning. Every child has a relationship with food, be it good or bad. You can use that in all types of curriculum areas. You can teach the Aztecs, you can teach the Tudors through a potato.
You are very like eating apples.
Well, we could put our headphones on and try and taste some of the food.
We'll see what the sound is like in your head, shall we? What are you going to eat?
A carrot.
A carrot.
It's loud.
It is.
Well, we saw Taste Ed in practice, but what is Taste Ed?
I've been working with the food writer Bea Wilson. Bea looked at it through her book First Bite, and I had contacted SAPRA, who are an organisation that was based in France, who were noticing children were eating very, very soft food. They didn't have a big expanse of taste that they were exploring with, and so they set up an organisation that then went into Sweden and is now part of the national curriculum in Finland, and started to explore how we could introduce the SAPRA method within our curriculum that we had here.
What did you think last year when Dame Sally Davis, the chief medical officer, put out this big report?
I thought it was a great thing for someone of that stature, the chief medical officer, to highlight this issue. And as her parting paper that she did, she was saying this is really, really important. We need to get this sorted. Previously to that, we'd had the childhood obesity plan, and then we had chapter 2 of the childhood obesity plan, and they weren't as radical as we wanted them to be. There's some good things going on, but there's an awful lot to do before we can get this problem solved.
Molly, Eli,
Oscar,
tell me how old you all are.
I'm 6.
I'm 7. I'm the oldest in the class.
You have Taste Ed lessons, don't you?
Yeah. I think they're really good because you try all different types of food that you've never tried before.
What was something you tried in Taste Ed that you've not had before?
Rocket. So the rocket reuse, and they're really sweet.
When you go home after one of these lessons, do you talk about this with your mum and dad? You do?
I told them that we should try doing what we did in the Taste Ed lesson.
I've had parents come up to me and say, well, how did you get little Billy to try sweet potatoes? He's never tried them before at home.
Some people might ask, you know, why is it the responsibility of a school to do this?
If I want these children to leave a rich and diverse life and make the most of their talents, then this is a key area that they need to be learning about.
Is this really going to be the way to tackle this, a problem so big?
I think education would solve many of society's ills. This generation of children are the first generation that won't outlive their parents. If you are eating healthily, good proportions, then the issues that come with obesity will go. And you've got to start somewhere. If you start with these children, then that will make a difference.
Do you think what you're learning now will change you as you get grow into young?
Definitely, yes. My big brother Leo, when he for some reason he grows and grows every morning, and I think that's because he's eating healthy.
I'm still based on custard creams.
The truth is, Molly, I love custard creams.
I do.
Well done.
Is there a rock?
Hello.
After science, can you come down and get Oscar's autograph?
I'm sure I will do. I'll bring my autograph book down. Well done, Oscar.
Stop talking about all of this food stuff. I'm getting hungry.
Are you?
It's hard not to be impressed by the children at Washingborough Academy. But is it realistic to ask schools to do more? When this academic read Dame Sally Davis's report, she felt she'd good reason to be a bit sceptical.
My feeling is that there's almost too much emphasis on what schools can do and not necessarily considering how that needs to fit within other aspects that are going on. They do have some role, but it's a tiny role within a much bigger picture. I'm Peymaneh Adab, I'm Professor of Public Health at the University of Birmingham. I've been working in childhood obesity prevention for over a decade now.
Professor Adab's caution was based on a large randomised control trial she led in 2005 called the WAVE study. 55 primary schools in the West Midlands took part, and after consulting with teachers and families, they introduced different activities.
Some of them were related to food and diet and improving healthy eating, and some of them were related to increasing physical activities in children. Parents were invited in to work with their children one day each term. So this programme continued for one school year. We measured the children at the beginning, at the end, and then for some period after the intervention had finished as well. Unfortunately, what we found was that it had no impact on the children's weight status, their diet, or their physical activity. So it didn't seem that it was an effective intervention. We don't know exactly why, but we have some clues. Some of the hypotheses are around whether what we did was enough, so maybe it needed to be much more intensive. What we do know is that schools really struggle to deliver even what we asked them to. So I think in reality, to do anything more intensive would have been very difficult to do. There is a process called the Cochrane Review, where they have the highest level of evidence and summary of all these trials. On an individual level, the effects are so small that they might not even be clinically important. We can't ignore the role of schools, but any effect that they have is going to be tiny.
To quote Dame Sally Davis, there is no magic bullet. Solving childhood obesity is complicated. But maybe the solution comes from more joined-up thinking. Before we hand over to our expert panel next week, there's another conversation I wanted to include with someone thinking and working outside the usual confines of the childhood obesity debate. Professor Sarah Hawkes is Director for the Centre for Gender and Global Health at University College London. Over the years, she's developed international policy on sexual health and human rights, but now her team have turned their attention to children.
Mainly it's fast foods, like on the bus tickets, on the back it's always like a coupon.
I remember seeing one of the adverts on the TV and it made me really hungry, it made me dribble.
It just makes me feel like I want to eat it.
In the six countries where we were working, so that's Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, Tunisia and Vietnam, and in the UK, children themselves were given cameras to go out and just film their food environment. One common issue relates to advertising. And we've got a great clip from a child in Mile End, for example.
I always say McDonald's.
And who simply says, if I say the word McDonald's enough times, my mother eventually gives in and buys me a McDonald's. And that was repeated, not necessarily for McDonald's, but it was repeated again and again across the six countries. I mean, it would be wrong to lay the blame entirely at the door of the advertising or food industry. I mean, it builds into a much deeper set of societal changes that are happening all over the world.
I mean, you are painting a picture of a problem that is international in scope. Does that mean we need to solve the problem on an international level?
Of course, there are things that you can do, not just at a national level, but at a local level, and all of that should be encouraged. But if what you want to do is turn off the tap rather than sort of mop up all of the symptoms, you are then talking about a set of problems that are global problems. We've got very good examples of when the world decides to take action at a global level. So an obvious example is the control of tobacco. It's really difficult for a single country to decide to put tax on tobacco products, for example, or to ban advertising. But when it's a global agreement that nobody will allow the advertising of tobacco and everybody will tax tobacco, then you get a reduction in tobacco consumption. And that's what we're seeing across Europe, for example.
There is this language of the sin tax, nannying. How does anybody who disagrees with these tactics, how do you change that language?
There are very good examples that show that it is possible to shift the narrative. So, for example, if you look at the history of the AIDS epidemic in this country in the 1980s through to the early 1990s, the original language was about individual responsibility. It was about the bad things that immoral people were doing to themselves. And, you know, questions were raised about why public funds should be spent solving self-created problems. And that narrative changed very quickly, really, to one of human rights.
Do you think we are collectively thinking about child obesity as a serious international threat to our health?
It is somewhat recognised, but the recognition is certainly not in line with the size of the problem. The world will mobilise over an issue that it sees as an immediate threat. You know, not to put too fine a point on it, it's a lot easier to go out and raise money based on pictures of undernourished and starving children than to raise money based on pictures of overweight and obese children. It's a discussion that needs to be had openly about how we allocate our attention and resources.
And it's a discussion we'll continue next week on this programme. How do you think we should try to solve child obesity in the UK? Well, go online and send us your thoughts and questions now. We are at BBC Food Prog on Twitter and Instagram, or email us thefoodprogramme@bbc.co.uk.
Our whole lives we've been bound by stereotypes. Young people are bad. Young people in hoodies are dangerous. Young people love junk food. What a stereotype. Government has to step in and help regulate the industry and help tell businesses what to do. Businesses have to step in and change the way that they market their products and change the way that they offer it to the consumer. And then our communities have to work together so we can hold them to account. So that how we've seen with the climate change movement, young people as a community, they've come together and they've held the countries, they've held world leaders, they've held politicians to account, because we've suddenly realised that we only have like 12 years left before climate change becomes irreversible. But look at the damages of obesity. We live 10 years younger than our parents.
If you're listening to some other podcast, then stop now and listen to a good one, because The Impotent Monkey Cage is back for a new series, and we're doing loads of things, aren't we, Robin?
We're going to be dealing with the science of laughter, conspiracy theories, coral reefs, quantum worlds, and finally UFOs. I love UFOs. It's also, by the way, the UFO one available to watch on iPlayer. In fact, all of the series that we've done are available on BBC Sounds.
I must say that I wouldn't bother with the first series. I don't think it's very good.
I wouldn't bother with the first two.
Yeah.
But we were played by different people then, I think, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Melvin Bragg was you, and
you were Debbie McGee.
Debbie McGee, yeah.
Bragg and McGee. Now that is a 1980s TV detective series that I will be making.